Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Daniel Foster of National Review Online, and for Jim Garrity today, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Dan, Benghazi's kind of been the big story all week. Not only the dramatic testimony from Greg Hicks and two others on Wednesday before Congress, but also some of the information we learned leading up to that from Cheryl Atkinson of CBS and others. Now we learn from Jonathan Carl at ABC News that there's even more to the Benghazi story, which we assumed more details would be coming. This specifically related to the talking points that initially came from the intelligence community and then got dramatically changed before Susan Rice hit those Sunday morning talk shows a couple of days later. And now we find out just how significant those changes were.
The White House said they relied entirely on CIA talking points, but I have obtained 12 different versions of those talking points that shows that they were dramatically edited by the administration. Take a look at two of them. On the left, a draft initially written by the CIA. On the right, one that was used by the White House, the final version. What was taken out? All references to Al-Qaeda and all references to CIA warnings before the attack about the terror threat in Benghazi.
And so you might be wondering, well, what possible explanation would the administration have for doing that? Jonathan Carl has something on that, too.
I have had emails read to me that show that many of these changes were directed by Hillary Clinton's spokesperson at the State Department, Victoria Nuland. In one email, she said that information about CIA warnings, quote, could be abused by members of Congress to beat up the State Department for not paying attention to warnings. So why would we want to feed that? After that email, all of those references were deleted.
Yeah, why would we want to feed the truth out there, Dan? Because Republicans might jump on it, right? Let's just go with a completely different narrative instead.
The word abused is unusually deployed in that email. I mean, just dealing with the substance of this, it's obviously very disturbing. It's also the closest thing that we have on this piece of the Benghazi scandal to the smoking gun or the lukewarm slingshot that was referred to in the hearings the other day. I mean, you know, not to make too much light of this, it's very disturbing, and it shows just the brute politicization of a national security scandal. But my first thought was, imagine if it was Joe Biden who leaked these emails. He would basically be Kaiser Soze to Hillary Clinton's, Chaz Palminteri, in the Usual Suspects reference. We all sort of think it's bumbling Uncle Joe, but can you think of a better way, for him with privileged access to this stuff to sink early on Hillary's chances in 2016? I wouldn't be surprised if it was, if not Joe Biden, one of his handlers.
That is very intriguing and very Machiavellian, but I'll tell you that if there's going to be somebody that has to take the fall, it's clearly not going to be the administration. I don't think they want to sabotage Hillary Clinton, but if it's, if it's us or her, it's going to be us that gets the bacon saved. I think it's going to be their attitude towards here.
Right, absolutely. And we know that Biden's starting to seriously think about his own run. He's been cut off at the knees in, two presidential competitions himself. So why not take a turn at bat and cutting off his biggest principal rival, at least this early on, with something like this? I mean, who knows? But, obviously these emails were leaked from within the White House, which is what the verbiage of the story seems to suggest. Or maybe from within the State Department itself. Maybe there's another whistleblower involved. But it's someone high up the food chain. I mean, because this is strategy stuff they're talking about. So who knows?
Yeah, somebody who's got clearance. And, those first two Biden campaigns were so successful.
Right.
Didn't even get off the ground the first time because of the plagiarism scandal. And then I think he got 0% in Iowa before dropping out. And ultimately he got rescued by Obama by making the VP on the ticket. But that'd be fascinating if this was Joe Biden's
work. Third time's the charm.
I guess so. From 0% to 0% to, I guess, a majority somehow. But you got to start somewhere. And if you're gonna start taking out your biggest rival, obviously Hillary's got a lot to answer for. I think it's going to be hard for her to avoid testifying on this again. And we'll see who else from the administration ends up getting invited or subpoenaed up to Capitol Hill, because the more that we learn, the more questions that need to be answered by those people. So on to martini number two now, Dan, and the big legislative story, or one of them anyway, over the last few weeks and continues to be, is this Senate immigration bill, the Gang of Eight. The Senate Judiciary Committee is currently wading through a whole slew of amendments. And as Byron York points out in the Washington Examiner today, yesterday was basically kill all substantive border security amendments day for the committee. The Democrats have the majority on the panel, 10 to 8. They also have two of the Republican members of the Gang of Eight. So really, they had 12 to 6 votes on anything that was controversial. So in terms of finishing the fence or, you know, making sure that Congress has officially declared that the border is secure or redefining operational control to mean something substantive, all of those were shot down. And Lindsey Graham and Jeff Flake, who are the two Gang of Eight members on the committee who are Republicans, going right along with it, which means that this really is more about legalization than tightening up the border.
Yeah, you know, and in Jeff Flake's case, you saw his approval numbers at home dip quite a bit after his gun vote. So maybe he's trying to, you know, make good with some moderates there. Obviously, he supports the bill. He's in the Gang of Eight. But I don't get, under normal circumstances, why you'd have to vote no on these amendments, because, as you said, the Democrats hold the committee. It seems, leave aside the actual substance of the issue, it seems like it would just make sense for Flake to go along with these tough amendments because his vote isn't needed in this case to get them through. So this might be him trying to play a little bit back towards the middle in his home state. But I will say this, I think a lot of us were absolutely thrilled when Jeff Flake became a United States Senator. And it just shows you that you never really know where these guys – I'm not saying he's a bad Republican or any coming to any definitive conclusions, but it shows that you never really know where these guys are going to go when they get promoted.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, this is the same state where at least relatively recently was pretty gung-ho behind SB 1070, and obviously that got Jan Brewer reelected by a wide margin out there. So I'm not sure that going wobbly on border security is the way that Arizona wants him to go either. But
that's a good point. That's a good point.
Obviously, he's got a long way to go before he's up for reelection in, was it 2018? So he has a lot of time to redeem himself. But hopefully somehow this bill will be changed. And we'll be interested to see if Rubio gets a little bit frustrated here, because he said that this legislation needs to be toughened in terms of border security. And right now, his fellow Republicans on this are not going along with it. And maybe that'll doom the bill in the Senate. Maybe it'll doom it in the House. But as long as it gets doomed somewhere in its current status, that's the important thing. So,
Right. Meanwhile,
though, Dan, I don't know if you have a 3D printer. I don't even really have a concept in my mind what a 3D printer is. But apparently they are coming along and you can obviously print things out in 3D, which includes plastic guns. There is a company in Texas called Defense Distributed that made the first prototype of this, announced earlier in the week that they had successfully fired the weapon. So immediately the government has taken down their little blueprint online for how to do this. They say it could potentially violate weapons trafficking laws. Chuck Schumer, of course, wants to ban it entirely. Pretty stark reaction here from big government and Democrats in Congress, that their knee-jerk reaction here to something involving the right to bear arms is to immediately ban it.
As my colleague Charlie Cook, who writes so well about guns, you know, pointed out, there's nothing illegal about making a firearm in this country. It's fully legal. And for years and years and years, well, heck, for centuries, Americans who are, you know, qualified machine toolists have been making firearms at home. All you need is, a lathe and a couple, it's not that complicated of an industrial process. If you have basic machine tooling skills, you can make yourself a gun. The difference here is that, you know, you can just download it and hit the print button. And there's a 3D printer, Greg, to educate you. It's a fabricator. Instead, it's a blueprint. Some of them work by carving away material from a block. Some of them work by just millions and millions of layers, building up layers. But the end result is 3D objects, usually made out of some sort of plastic-like material. But they're getting more sophisticated, and there are now 3D printers that can print in multiple different materials. And they take hours and days sometimes because they're such complicated objects. But you end up with a gun, and if you see the YouTube video, it's not a particularly attractive gun. It looks like a box with a handle and a little barrel on it. But it works, and I think that the government is panicking because this is an example of, there's a reason why, the right to bear arms is considered a fundamental liberty. One of them is that it takes quite a lot of tyranny to take away people's guns. I mean, you really got to go, pretty hard from a big government perspective. It's not an easy thing to do. So, you're seeing that with this attempt to control the distribution of information might be the very first Second Amendment and First Amendment issue at the same, two in one combo. This is essentially censorship. And members of Congress can find technically constitutional ways to do this. I know that Steve Israel, before his big brother Chuck Schumer in New York took over the issue, Steve Israel's plan was to ban this through the undetectable weapons legislation, which says that you can't have a gun that can make it through a metal detector. And that's kind of the angle they're going to take on it, which would be basically constitutional. This seems like, as you put it, a pretty stark move, and I hope there's some pushback, and I trust that there will be.
I hope so. I mean, given that the I like to call them the Gang of Three on the Senate side, you know, Rand Paul and Ted Cruz and Mike Lee, you know, they stood very strong against any infringement of Second Amendment rights just a couple of weeks ago. I'm guessing they'll be on the right side of this one as well. But one more thing to keep track of. Dan, have a fabulous weekend. Thanks again for being with us.
Thank you, Greg.
Daniel Foster, news editor at National Review Online, and for Jim Garrity today, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join Jim and me on Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.